You know, it's time of Thanksgiving. We're reminded over and over. We see it in the stores. We see it on the roads. We see it in the newspapers with the ads that come in. Look at the bundles of things that come in, particularly if you have a newspaper subscription. You look in your mailbox, and you're going to see things flooding out. And you know that time is upon us when they've launched that, where when you live in a well-to-do country where people look very much to to the accoutrements of their wealth, the things that are surrounding us. And we have an opportunity, as the sermonette mentioned, to give thanks for that opportunity because we are well blessed. Well, today I want to take a look a little deeper into this subject as to why rich nations are rich and poor nations are poor. Why rich nations are rich and why poor nations are poor. Those of you that can project will probably put the subtitle down, Promises to Abraham. Because we believe in the promises to Abraham, as the Bible outlines. We believe in God's enduring righteousness. We know that the righteousness is God's faithfulness in fulfilling all the promises that he made to the Father of the faithful. And as promised, God multiplied Abraham's lineal descendants so that Abraham became, quite literally, the father of many nations. We believe that God has promised materially and materially prospered Abraham's lineal descendants, Isaac and Jacob, whose name, Jacob's name was later changed to Israel. We believe that God, through Abraham's seed, Jesus Christ, is making salvation available to all humanity, regardless of physical lineage. Salvation, then, is not a right of birth. It is freely open to all whom God calls. And those who are regarded as descendants of Abraham are those of the faith, heirs according to the promise. We believe that the knowledge that God has fulfilled and continues to fulfill the physical promises made to Abraham and his children, and that he is fulfilling the spiritual promises through Jesus Christ, which is critical for understanding the message of the prophets and its application to the world. So that's really a listing of a fundamental belief about the promises to Abraham. I want to take a look at two questions today that layer on top of that, and that is, why? And the other question is, how? Well, we have the Abrahamic covenant, from which the blessings of Abraham flow forth. And we open up by looking at Genesis 12 and verse 3. In Genesis 12 and verse 3, what did God say? I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all families of the earth shall be blessed. Wow. Wouldn't it be something if God came up to you and to me and said, in you all families of the earth will be blessed. This was a particularly important blessing. And this is repeated throughout Genesis. We have what? Genesis 14, 19, Genesis 18, 18, in Genesis 22, 18. It repeats this, Genesis 26, 4. I will give your descendants to all these lands, in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. And in Genesis 28, 14, it repeats it, in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So we have this blessing that's coming forth, the Abrahamic blessing, the Abrahamic covenant. And it was made to Abraham in Genesis 15 through 18. And then it was confirmed to his son Isaac, and then to Isaac's son Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel. So if we read in Genesis 15, we read about the capture of Abraham's nephew Lot by five kings, and we read how Abraham and 318 of his mounted men, who were armed warriors, went after Lot and recaptured Lot and offered then offerings to Melchizedek, the priest at Salem. And following that, we then hear what God had to say to Abram. Following that, those events. Then he brought him outside and said, look now toward heaven. And he believed in the Lord, meaning Abraham, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. God accounted it. And so, on verse 18, on the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, his name wasn't yet changed to Abraham, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. And then he names a number of the places. There was a physical blessing. in Genesis 26:3, dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham, your father. This was repeated when he told this to Isaac. He told the same thing to Jacob in Genesis 23:31. In Genesis 23, I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the sea, Philistia to the river, from the desert to the river. And for if you serve, and he goes on to verse 33, for if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So there's a warning that goes on. I'm giving you all these blessings. They're physical blessings, but you be very careful not to let those gods of those other peoples be a snare. So what happened? In Hebrews 11, verse 8, in Hebrews 11, we read, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go to a place where he would receive an inheritance. Remember those promises of all that land and the place to go? And he went out, not knowing where he was going. I've been to places that I had never been before. And God had placed his name to go to some place for the feast, and I went there, and I thought, well, I don't know what this is like. And I went there. Abraham had more faith. He moved there. He wasn't just visiting. Verse 9, by faith he, meaning Abraham, dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in the tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. So we understand that there are promises to Abraham for being faithful. And then we go to Genesis 22, and we read the story of Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac, and we know this is a foretype of the offering of the sacrifice of Christ. And Abraham was willing to do this, even though somehow it just didn't make sense according to the promise that he was given that his descendants would be as the stars of the sky and of the sand at the sea. Yet his willingness then showed his faithfulness to God. And in Genesis 22, then, starting in verse 16, by myself I have sworn, said the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. The blessing with blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars in heaven and the sand of the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you've obeyed my voice. When you look at the gate of their enemies, if you look at, there's some people have done some interesting studies, and you look at all of the narrowing sea gates around the world, whether it's Gibraltar or Singapore, at one time those were controlled by what was the British Empire. We'll read into that as we keep going. I'm going to look at Psalm 111, verses 1 through 10. I'm not going to read all of it, but we don't know who wrote Psalm 111. We call the person the psalmist, but it's an acrostic psalm, which means that each sentence begins with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, and the second sentence would then begin with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet and so forth, but it's translated to English, so we lose some of that acrostic value. Let's go to verse 4. He has made his wonderful works to be remembered. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion. He has given food to those who fear him. He will ever be mindful of his covenant. It doesn't say he will be giving food to those who disobey and disagree with him. It doesn't say he'll be given food to those who cause trouble. It says he has given food to those, meaning sustenance, to those who fear him. And we go down to verse 9. He has sent redemption to his people. He has commanded his covenant forever. This is a reference to the Abrahamic covenant, the offering of a spiritual promise here to those who follow God's commandments, that this commandment, this covenant, the covenant, if we keep the commandments, will endure. And verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. His praise endures forever. Well, what about these spiritual promises? If we read in Romans 4 and verse 16, we see that Paul in his letter to the Romans wrote that the promises to Abraham are not just to Abraham and the descendants, specifically physical descendants of Abraham. In Romans 4:16, Therefore, it's of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, but also those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. So all seed, meaning all of those who follow Christ, that's the seed who are faithful. Now, the Apostle Paul emphasized that Christians would inherit the promises to Abraham. And Paul goes on to write in Romans 9 and verses 7 and 8. In Isaac your seed shall be called, that is, those who are the children of the flesh, those who are, meaning not just, these are not just the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted as seed. So if you follow Abraham, and you follow what Abraham did, you can also be counted as the seed, as an inheritor of the promises to Abraham. Paul also writes to the Galatians in 3:16. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say, and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ. So Paul is clarifying this promise that those who are believers in Christ, the sacrifice and the redemption offered through Christ, then become seeds of Abraham, or seeds to the promises of Abraham. And so we have this this opportunity to follow or become the seed of Abraham, not just because we're physical descendants of Abraham, and some special chosen ones, although we certainly may be. You know, it was... And I've stopped and I have to laugh at myself. Some of you may know Steve Collins, who has written a number of books regarding the children of Israel, the tribes of Israel, and how they've expanded. And I thought, 45 years ago, when we had dinner together as young bachelors, we would never imagine that either one of us would have be in the position that we're at, where he would be writing and I would be speaking about these same issues. And yet he's written about the tribes of Israel and how they've scattered around the earth, and how those have particularly inherited some of the promises, of physical promises of God. In Luke 3, verse 8, therefore bear fruits worthy of repentance, and do not begin to say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father. For I say to you that God is able to raise up children to Abraham for these stones. So it's not enough just to be descendant from Abraham. Because if God wanted just descendants from Abraham, well, raise up the stones and we can have some more. He wants those who believe and trust in the way of God. And that's repeated on in Romans 8, Romans 9, where we have those kinds of blessings that will come forth, both the physical and the spiritual blessings. And when we look around the world, we see that those who trace their physical ancestry to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have been materially blessed. And so certainly we have the worship here coming for an understanding of the Thanksgiving here in the United States. Canada had its Thanksgiving on October 8th, I believe, this year. So I have a friend in Canada. Actually, his wife is a Canadian. He lives in Oregon, and she sent a happy Thanksgiving Day memo to me through Facebook, and I wrote back and said, happy regular Thursday to you Canadians, because they already had theirs a little earlier. But did these physical blessings just happen out of the blue? Did God wave a wand or sprinkle a bottle of pixie dust on all of Abraham's offspring? Is there a reason or a set of reasons that the physical blessings resulted in physical blessings to the descendants of Abraham? Well, as a historian and an economist, I have a particular interest in how these blessings came to be. If we take a look at the beginning of recorded history to the year 1750 AD, a little over 250 years ago, the standard of living of the people on earth had roughly doubled. In nearly 6,000 years, that's all the progress that humans have made. When you go from caveman to, or you know, early natural living to modern conveniences. And then even in 1750, this tremendously blessed country, most of humanity did not have running water. They didn't have toilet tissue, cotton underwear, or factory-made shoes. most of the comforts of life that we now take for granted were unheard of by most people on Earth. About 90% of the people on Earth were engaged in subsistence farming, growing enough food to stay alive, and perhaps trade a little extra food to other people in exchange for other necessities of life. But about the year 1750, something happened. Well, first, let's explain more clearly what poverty means, because poverty still exists around the world. Poverty means hunger. Poverty can mean lack of shelter. Poverty is being sick and not receiving any medical assistance. Poverty is not having access to an education, not knowing how to read. Poverty is not having a job or fear for the future, just living one day at a time. Poverty is losing a child to illness that may be brought about perhaps by unclean water. Poverty is powerlessness, a lack of freedom. Every 3.6 seconds, someone dies of hunger, and about 75% of those deaths are children. But there's a difference between absolute poverty and relative poverty. Poverty, defined in terms of the minimal requirements necessary to afford basic standards of food, clothing, and health care and shelter, that's just that's a general definition of poverty. But in Asia, Africa, and Latin American countries, over 500 million people live in what the World Bank calls absolute poverty. Every year, 15 million children die of hunger. And throughout the 1990s, more than 100 million children died from illness and starvation. The World Health Organization estimates that one-third of the world is well-fed, one-third is underfed, and one-third is starving. Since I've been speaking today, at least 200 people have died of starvation, and over 4 million will die this year. Half of all children under 5 years of age in South Asia and one-third of those in sub-Saharan Africa are seriously malnourished. That's absolute poverty. And then there's relative poverty. A middle-class family is relatively poorer than a famous model or and relatively richer than a struggling artist. All three are above the absolute poverty line. So they're relatively, one is poorer than the next and so forth. It's difficult for those of us in the United States where the per capita productivity in 2002 is about $36,000. In other words, how much is produced in a nation in 1 year is considered the gross domestic product. Then you divide that by the number of people. So to grasp that, about 2.8 billion, or about half the world's population, lives on less than $2 a day. And of those, about 1.2 billion live on less than a dollar a day. The productivity or gross domestic product per person in America is over four times the world average. The per capita in the United States of gross domestic product or productivity per person averages around $36,000 from 1960 to last year. If you take a look, it was had a record low in 1960 of $17,000 per person. So now this is relatively a lot of productivity in recent history. But what happened then in the year 1750 AD? If we take a look, there's a time capsule offering by a 1993 Nobel address by Douglas North. And I want to read just a few excerpts that he's offered in his address to accept the Nobel Prize in Economics. Population may have grown from about 300 million at the time of Christ to about 800 million people by the year 1750. A substantial acceleration as compared to earlier rates of growth. So it was slow growth up until the year 1750. If you were to take, and these are my words, but if you were to take the last 6,000 years of recorded human history and you put them on a 24-hour time clock, the last 250 years represents about 1 hour of human history. So what has happened in the last hour of this 24-hour time clock has been an enormous amount of productivity. In the last 250 years, this era of modern economic growth by a population explosion puts the world, in 1993, was 5 billion people when he gave the address. It's now over 7 billion in the year 2018. So since recorded history began, world population grew to about 500 million people by 1750. And then it started shooting upwards. Now, 250 years later, the world population is over 7 billion. What happened? Why? The Mr. North continues on, if we focus on the last 250 years, we see that growth was largely restricted to Western Europe and the overseas extensions of Great Britain for 200 of the 250 years. I might interject, without his comment, these are largely the descendants of Abraham. Mr. North goes on, advances in food production from new technology, commonly labeled the world's second agricultural revolution, coincide with this population explosion. Improvements in the spread of the use of the plow was first introduced in the Fertile Crescent, the Mesopotamian Valley, where Abraham came from, around 4000 BC, and it changed very little over the next 5,000 years. And you contrast the development of the plow to the development of air travel. The first successful motor-driven flight occurred in 1903 by the Wright brothers. In 1969, 69 years later, Neil Armstrong became the first man to put his foot on the moon. If you take a look at what's occurred since 1750, and I have an interesting graph, and I'm just going to read some of the things that have occurred since 1750. The end of the Black Plague, you had discovery of the colonization of the New World. Actually, this started around the 1400s and 1500s. And now you have the beginning of the agricultural revolution and then the industrial revolution, the invention of the steam engine, the beginning of railroads, the beginning of the understanding of what we call germ theory, why diseases even exist. It wasn't understood well before that. The invention of the telephone and electricity, invention of the automobile. As we roll forward, we had the invention of the airplane, and then came along penicillin, the use of, and the war on malaria, which the Western Hemisphere was wiped out, malaria. We had the discovery of DNA, why people inherit what they do. We've had high-speed computers. We now have nuclear energy, man on the moon, then personal computers, and interesting, the Genome Project, sourcing out the details of understanding of how mankind has been built. God knew all of this ahead of time. We just took a little while to figure it out. But since 1750, all of that has occurred. In 1776, there was a Scottish philosopher and the first modern economist named Adam Smith, and he wrote a book that's titled Wealth of Nations. He built on the Enlightenment philosopher John Locke's treatise on natural rights and wealth creation. Adam Smith explained the purpose of government was to protect natural rights of property ownership, as did John Locke. And if a government did so, then productivity of the world would increase and wealth would grow. In his book, The 5,000-Year Leap, W. Cleon Skousen explained how wealth was created when the United States was born. Prior to that time, nations obtained wealth by taking it from other people. But after the United States was formed, people were able to become wealthy, not by taking wealth from other people, but by serving the needs and wants of other people. Does that sound biblical to you, by serving other people? The rule of law was put in place by this new country to replace what they had had previously, which is the law of rulers. The law of rulers did not allow for productivity and wealth creation. This is, Mr. Skousen wrote, this is a profound explanation as to how America grew from a developing colony to the wealthiest nation in world history. The United Kingdom and its offspring, as well as Western Europe, followed suit in modeling its economic expansion based on property rights and a consistent rule of law. Now, it's interesting, some of this information, following information I got from the Foundation for Teaching Economics, and I usually take a course from them each summer, and they examined what poverty looked like throughout history, and they posit, and it's FTE.org is their website, for most people, poor diet was not a matter of bad choices. It was the absence of choices, the fact of scarcity. poor diets and chronic malnutrition were the norm, and I might add are the norm, that when food production rose, rarely rose above basic life-sustaining levels. And most people were caught in what we call the food energy trap. Low food supplies, inadequate diet, high rate of disease, low rates of resistance. And then there was the second agricultural revolution beginning then in the late 1700s. And we had the Industrial Revolution, and then which then lowered infant mortality rates. Children began to live to adulthood. Mothers began to survive the maternity experience. The world as a whole took thousands of years for life expectancy, and this is where you average everybody that's born and what their life expectancy. So a child that dies will bring the life expectancy down. For thousands of years, for the life expectancy to rise from the low 20s to around 30s by the 1750. The low life expectancy was because of high infant mortality and maternal mortality. And the rest of the world slept after 1750, or much of it did, except for Europe and England's colonies in America. By the early 1800s, the United States had gone ahead of Europe, and by the mid-1900s, the citizens of the U.S. had enjoyed incomes well above those Europeans and many nations of people living elsewhere. The real impact of regional differences is apparent when we realize that the poor nations of today, and we've all heard of them, Zaire, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Burma, Bangladesh, have per capita incomes that Europe had back between 500 and 1,000 years ago. Those places are still there. So there's very little growth. So the low-income countries, even now, have not attained the well-being experienced by people who Western people at the time of the American Revolution over 250 years ago. The World Bank classifies countries into high income, middle income, and low income. And the high income nations, they line out IACs, industrially advanced countries, include the United States, Japan, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and most of the nations of Western Europe. The countries of that we could say were descendants of Abraham or took on the economic system of the descendants of Abraham. And then we look at the low-income nations that have, as of 8 years ago, had annual incomes of $745 per person. And these would be India, Indonesia, and the sub-Saharan nations of Africa. So this road out of poverty is only within the last 250 years. Not very many countries have really gotten out of it. So what steps have what we look at as the children of physical children of Abraham, what did they do to lead humanity along the road to plenty? Well, if you've had economics class, and I presume a number of you had, you know there's four characteristics that lead to either wealth or poverty, and it's how you make decisions about land or natural resources, labor, human labor, capital investment, and entrepreneurship, which is a freedom to invest and invent and manage. So if we take a look at the way nations apply and adapt these sources of productivity, it leads to the discovery of three factors. And these three factors, remarkably discovered by secular economists, are in line with what we'll read in the Bible. Wealthy nations have these three characteristics: private property, a set of laws or rules or institutions that promote and protect private property, and third, a free market exchange of private property. And to the extent that these three characteristics exist, a nation will become wealthier. To the extent that these three characteristics are lacking, a nation becomes poorer. And although the economists who discovered these causal relationships to wealth and poverty didn't realize it, all three things are biblically based. And to the extent that these principles are followed, a nation will enjoy an increase in wealth and demonstrate then the blessings promised to Abraham. Let's take a look at characteristic number one. The Bible promotes and protects private property. The Ten Commandments speak directly to the issue of private property. The easy one you can read in Exodus 20, verse 15, you shall not steal. Well, if you don't own anything, it doesn't matter if somebody takes it or not, it's not yours to begin with. So we have that you shall not steal. And in verse 17, Exodus 20, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, your wife, a neighbor's wife, his male servant, female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. So this is something that belongs to someone else. Don't wish you had it. Then we have in Exodus 20, in verse 8, we have, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, your son, your daughter, nor your male servant, your female servant, nor your cattle, nor the stranger who is within your gates. I might note here that when this was carved into stone, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, there was a mixed multitude, and many came with them, and the expectations for those people were the same as the people of the children of Abraham, the children of Israel. So all of those were expected to keep the same laws and expectations. The Old Testament has a number of other characteristics about protecting private property. We can read in Deuteronomy 19:14. In Deuteronomy 19:14, you shall not move your neighbor's boundary stone which the ancestors have set. This is followed up in a number of other cases. Deuteronomy 27:17, cursed is he who moves his neighbor's boundary mark. Now, I grew up on a farm, and that farm, my great-grandfather homesteaded. They marked out the characteristics, all of the lines. They recorded that at the county seat, and everybody knew where the county lines were. And people generally put a corner post at the corner of their property. People would show that or there would be, and this is where there was the land was laid out in a grid pattern, and it was you would place a boundary there. And so we hear this reinforced in Proverbs 22:28. Don't remove the ancient boundary which your fathers have set. And so this repeatedly goes over, reinforces the concept that there are boundaries, there are places that would reinforce the idea of real estate. And then we read this, continues on in Job 24, verse 2. In Job 24, verse 2, he provides a list of people that do evil things. And he says, some remove landmarks, but he goes on, that's real estate. They seize and devour flocks. That's personal property. We read about that in the Ten Commandments. In other words, don't take things from others. People have things. We read in 1 Kings 21, and I'm not going to go through all of that, but it's the story of the prophet Elijah's rebuke of Ahab and Jezebel for the murder of Naboth and their acquisition of his vineyard. It's a classic biblical story of coveting and theft and of murder. Elijah pronounced a severe judgment on Ahab and Jezebel for the wicked deed. But the Old Testament is the only place where we read about the concept of private property. We had in the sermonette today in Matthew 25 about the parable of talents. They were belonged to somebody and not to somebody else. And productivity was expected when you're taking care of other people's property. Jesus Christ himself was reciting some of the Ten Commandments, or at least the rich young ruler in Mark 10 and Luke 18 says, you know, what shall I do? And Christ said, keep the commandments. Which ones? And he included in there, do not steal. We also have the example of Zacchaeus, the man who climbed the sycamore tree to see Christ. And when he met Christ, he said, if I've done anything wrong, this is in Luke 19, verse 8, if I've done anything wrong, I will restore fourfold. Now, he was a tax collector. If I've cheated anybody, I'll pay him back four times, acknowledging that he might have taken something that somebody else, even if he did it by accident or not on purpose, because he said he didn't mean to. But the fourfold repayment was the standard penalty in Hebraic law for fraud. Repay times four. There are other circumstances like that as well. You might read Romans 13:8. I'm not going to turn there, but Paul argues about the eighth commandment is part of what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. Well, if you're going to love your neighbor, you're going to respect his property. You're not going to want his property or steal from his property, just like you wouldn't want somebody else to take from yours. Paul does write, and I am going to turn to 1 Corinthians 6 in verse 9. In 1 Corinthians 6 in verse 9 and 10. And this is where Paul lists that habitual thieves will not inherit the kingdom of God. Paul states, he who steals must steal no longer. In other words, turn from that way. But rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so he will have something to share with one who has need. So this this whole concept, and that would be in Ephesians 4:28, to be able to share with others. That's a voluntary sharing, and we'll get into that in a moment. So this whole idea of biblical respect for property and the possessions of others is very important for establishing human well-being throughout the modern world. And the people that have heeded those principles will experience more prosperity and growth for all. The Bible doesn't just address the importance of private property, but also establishes a second characteristic of building and maintaining wealth. Modern economists only more recently discovered that this second set of long-established biblical principles, and that's characteristic number two, the Bible contains and promotes a set of laws or rules and institutions that promote and protect private property. You might say it this way. The rule of law governs. And we're all law keepers. We understand and appreciate the rule of law that God has given to us. So we can understand that to the extent that a nation does not allow private property and protects the private property through the rule of law, through government institutions of law and order, a nation will become poor. We have modern examples of this. We have countries who have substituted the rule of law with, instead they put in place the law of rulers, which has been done, frankly, throughout history. But more modernly, we can look to Venezuela, North Korea, Cuba, Zimbabwe. Each of those countries have experienced a serious decline in wealth when they established the law of rulers instead of the rule of law. More recently, you may have heard about the government seizing privately owned farms in South Africa. It's an ongoing disaster. So the second characteristic is having a consistent rule of law. The third characteristic the Bible promotes and protects is voluntary free trade. The lack of free trade you may consider to be theft. If somebody orders you to do something and you didn't wish to do it, well, then they desired you to do something instead of you. And the Bible has a repeated message that it's wrong for a neighbor, even a king, to take what isn't his. We earlier referred to King Ahab and Jezebel wanting somebody else's vineyard. We read, "You shall not steal" in Exodus 20. And there's no qualifiers in those commandments. It simply applies the same, whether you're rich or poor or in between. In Proverbs 27:18, we read, "He who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit." Doesn't say he who tends the fig tree will be forced to give it to everybody else. It's unlike the early reason, the early Thanksgiving in America was when they divided up the property, or was it no longer communal property, but rather divided up the land and gave everybody their own parcel of land so they could produce on their own. And no longer were they all to contribute everything they had to the common store and then take out as they need. And for 2 years they starved until they changed the rules, a different set of rules. And the rules would be that everybody can keep what they make, keep what they grow. And now all of a sudden they had a surplus. And that surplus is the year that they then had in 1623, had the first Thanksgiving. In 2 Timothy 2:26, the Apostle Paul wrote, it's the hardworking farmer who ought to have his first share of the crop. In other words, the one who does the one who puts forth the effort should be able to partake of it. The one who works the land or catches the fish or makes the sale, designs, say, an operating system, repairs an air conditioner, has earned the right to enjoy the fruits of his labor. There's a fellow, a professor named Alan Dowd from the Sagamore Institute Center for America's Purpose. And he writes this. Promoting these characteristics of wealth creation on behalf of the wealth creator is not a rationalization for selfishness. Selfishness is a sin against God and against our fellow man, especially the poor. God cares deeply about helping the poor and promoting justice, which means we should as well. And he goes on to go through the number of examples where God calls on us to be voluntarily generous with what we have because of our productivity. But of course, unless we produce, we can't be voluntarily very generous with that. The Abrahamic promise and the Abrahamic covenant are with us today. God promised both physical blessings and spiritual blessings to the descendants of Abraham. God made it clear that the physical blessings would extend to Abraham's physical descendants, but those physical blessings would also be extended to Abraham's spiritual children. We simply have to accept our part of the bargain, to choose God's way of life, to choose to follow the commandments of God. God also made it clear that the spiritual blessings offered to Abraham are available to those who voluntarily become spiritual children of Abraham. Abraham is mentioned as one of God's faithful servants in Hebrews 11, verses 8 through 12. And yet, the spiritual promises made to Abraham are yet to come. In Hebrews 11, I'm going to read and starting in verse 13, after the list of God's faithful servants. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Well, many of Abraham's children have suffered through the ages. In Hebrews 11, verse 39, we're in that same chapter. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, didn't receive the promise, God having provided something better for us that we should not be made perfect apart from us. In other words, apart from faithfulness to God. Yet the promises to Abraham, we're talking the spiritual promises here, are available to us. Paul writes to the Galatians in chapter 3 and verse 26. In Galatians 3:26, "For you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you were baptized into Christ and have put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise." So we must do our part to receive the Abrahamic blessings. What is our part in James 2, final verse, or verses in James 2 and verses 20 through 26? "But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only." Verse 26, "For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also." Well, God made promises to Abraham. He made physical promises. He made spiritual and physical blessings and spiritual blessings for keeping his word. And when we follow Christ and keep God's laws, we can inherit both blessings. And for that, we can now understand that the countries that follow God's law, however inadequately, and follow the characteristics that God has outlined in the Bible, to that extent, they will become more productive and more wealthy. And to the extent that they do not, they will fail to thrive. Yet all individually, outside their national identity, have an opportunity to inherit the spiritual blessings of God.